Peter, I had a couple of data points and then a question. The data points were, I find it interesting that healthcare workers seem to have accepted some mandatory vaccinations, specifically hepatitis and some others. And I was kind of interested to fit that into your model of mandatory vaccination and outrage. You don't have to. You can decide whether you want to fit those into your model now. And the second point is to add into your impact of mandatory vaccination, not just the potential negatives, but you do get a stronger advocacy if the patient can ask the provider, have you taken the vaccination? And if the provider says they have taken it, that's a positive to that you might want to fit into your rubric or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, is this live?
Is it on? Can you hear us?
Okay. Now, okay. They're all on. Okay. I don't know the answer to your first question. It may be that the other vaccines are more demonstrably useful than the flu vaccine, and that healthcare workers, you know, are prepared to accept a mandatory vaccine that they approve of and not a mandatory vaccine that they don't see much use for. But I don't have any data to suggest that that's true. I simply don't know. On your second point, absolutely, a great deal depends on what a healthcare worker says to a patient who says, did you get it? But the healthcare worker's answer may not just be one syllable. You know, the healthcare worker who says, yeah, I got it because they made me, but you're free to do what you want. You know, I mean, it's not clear whether that would have a desirable or an undesirable effect. But I think it's enormously important to patient behavior to have healthcare workers giving good advice. And for me, a crucial question is whether good advice is likely or less likely after mandatory vaccination.
Can I just add one quick thing? Because I thought the same thing as you regarding hepatitis B vaccination. And I gave a talk last week on mandatory healthcare worker vaccination for influenza, and I looked up what the data are for hepatitis B vaccination among healthcare workers. And overall, it's 68%, and among physicians and nurses, it's 81%. So not everybody gets that one either, even though I think it's much easier to convince people that that's a good thing for them to get.
My question to you, Peter, is what about the provider who may not really believe in the vaccine? So how convincing are they in their communication with their patient in order for them to take the vaccine? If I don't really believe in it, how effective would I be in terms of convincing them to take the vaccine if I don't really believe in it?
Extremely ineffective. A stunning example of that is the healthcare establishment did not believe in the smallpox vaccination program. And that program was forced on them against their will and against the advice of the ACIP. And they were extremely successful in undermining it. The vast majority of people who administered that program managed to communicate to the folks they were offering the vaccine to that they thought they shouldn't take it.
So this is a question for Steve. That planning that Philadelphia and Harrisburg were doing that didn't square, what could have been done to have had a different outcome and a different process?
Well, I'd like to say that you shouldn't separately give vaccine to. I mean, it's a difficult issue because to a certain degree it's the same question that came up earlier. I think to you regarding, I think Esther asked the question about having a nationally consistent policy. Unfortunately, that's not the way public health works in the United States, which is each of the states has a prerogative to make decisions regarding how they're going to interpret federal recommendations and how they're going to implement them in their state. And I don't think that that's going to change. And I still happen to think it's the most appropriate thing to do. And so I think, unfortunately, we just have to live with the fact that circumstances are certainly different in a place like Philadelphia than they are in rural parts of Pennsylvania or other parts of the state, and we just have to accept it. There is no way that you can explain it otherwise or try to rationalize it. It's just the way it is.
I have a question for Virginia.
Did you want to? jump in?
Sorry.
Dr. Kane wanted to jump in.
I was trying to decide whether to put my two cents in. I think it is difficult when you have two different policies from a state versus a large metropolitan area. But the other side, on the other side of the fence is that sometimes, a lot of times when you're trying to implement something and you have to implement it quickly, you have to know who your partners are. And if you don't have that partnership strategy, when you have to dispense something out in a large period of time, sometimes it's very difficult for one entity like a state health department to have the ability to do that for every community in a way that sometimes may or may not be effective. So what I will tell you is it all depends on relationships and their level of communication. So, and I think that's really key. We're fortunate in Indiana that we had a fantastic relationship with our state versus our large metropolitan counties, but that's not always the case for other states. And so it's not as simple a solution, I think, sometimes in terms of addressing these issues.
I'd like to chime in on that too, if I could, very briefly. It seems to me that, you know, obviously life is easiest if every agency all over the country decides to do the same thing. But they don't. My sense is this is a country that's pretty accustomed to pluralism and pretty accustomed to governments doing different things in different places. I think we exacerbate the problem when we pretend that what we're going to do is obviously the right thing to do. Then it becomes inexplicable why Philadelphia is doing it differently. If we sounded more uncertain, more candid about, we're making it up as we go along, we're building our boat and sailing it at the same time, as David Heyman said during SARS. And if we sort of respectfully said, yeah, we've decided to do it this way, we know, the other agency has decided to do it this other way, we'll be watching what they do, they're watching what we do, together we'll figure out which way works better. Neither of us knows yet which way works better. I think the public would still rather you all did it the same way, but I think people can deal with that diversity of opinion if it's matter-of-factly expressed as a sign that nobody's sure, rather than as a sign that somebody must be an idiot.
And just one last thing. We made the decision that we were going to do the distribution in the school systems. In a lot of county health departments didn't have the staff to do that in their county. And I got accused of discrimination because I went to the public schools, but I didn't go to the parochial schools. So I got hugely, that's reverse discrimination. How come you're not coming to our private schools to provide this? And so we had to end up going to the private schools where we thought they had the resources and they could do the discrimination. So sometimes it's different resources and what you have available may end up in having different policies. Not that the smaller health departments or the rural health departments wouldn't have wanted to have that done. They just didn't always have the staffing and the resources to do it. So sometimes things are different solutions based on what you have available, local.
Okay. Dr. Breslin.
Sorry.
So you very clearly pointed out the differences in the disparity gaps in vaccination rates among children compared to adults. And in children, there are really no gaps. I think partly due to the fact that every state has a mandatory vaccination requirements. They may vary by state depending on the disease and the vaccine, but for the most part, they all have common elements, and so
especially when you go to school. So schools, you either.
Right, you needed to go to schools, and so that basically you're going to get equivalent uptake rates in all segments of the pediatric population. Adults are obviously different. They don't have any requirements for vaccinations. So the question to you is, and the disparities in a couple examples you showed for vaccines in adults, you know, have remained pretty consistent over time. What's if you had to pick one single thing that would make a difference to change that secular trend of a persistent disparity, what would it be? And do you think that the healthcare reform would have some contribution to closing that gap? So it's a two-part question.
Well, I think one, I think that the vaccine for children was a very successful program, so that for those parents who might not have had the dollars for the reimbursement from a vaccine standpoint, somebody else paid for it so they could get it. So that would, it would address all of those folks from an economic standpoint who couldn't afford to get it, but resolved at least the economic issues if you had a similar program for adults that you have for children from a national program. That's the first issue. I think the second issue is I just think we really have to do a better job of really educating our providers. I think that's really key. So I think it's two things: the education of the providers, and by that I mean that you really have to delve into what they really feel about these vaccines. So if they really don't believe it, how are you addressing that from a behavioral intervention change if they really don't believe it? And something is drastically wrong when 50% of your healthcare providers, just a little bit over it, are not getting the vaccine themselves. So that's some major issue that's telling us something. And so how do you address that? Because they are the, a lot of times they are the messenger. So if the messenger doesn't seem to get the message, are they credible messengers? But the other thing is, how do you make access available in a language where you're addressing their difficulties if you're receiving the vaccines from the vulnerable populations? And I think it's also an access issue. A lot of minority providers, they're getting out of the business of even distributing vaccines because it's costing them a lot of money. I can't compete with CVS. I can't compete with Walgreens if you continue to give me my vaccines late. I'm a small entity. You know, I can't buy them those big bulk doses. And so I'm not the first one on the list because I get a small supply and I'm paying for a small supply. So I think we have to, I think the federal government has to step in and say, how do we work with these minority providers or the people on the front line for some of these vulnerable populations? How do we work with them to make sure that things are being distributed? And I do want to compliment the regional administration. I think going to these non-traditional settings, like the pharmacies and the retails where you're giving vouchers to our vulnerable populations, can be incentives for them to get the vaccinations. But it's a tough sale if you're a boomer or older to get vaccinations for some of our populations.
Dr. Nelson.
Yeah, the discussion's largely been around risk communication during a pandemic and in response to a clear pandemic. And I'm curious to hear thoughts on the ability to communicate the risk of a pandemic itself. And I'm specifically thinking of you know, the perceived risk, at least within the preparedness community, of smallpox and anthrax, which elicits skepticism among others, perhaps. H5N1, which sort of is there but hasn't quite panned out, with not much documented human-to-human transmission. And so I'm just curious how these issues might, you know, how the communication of risk in terms of being prepared for a pandemic that is not at this time actually happening, and how one might approach those issues.
I'm going to say something. I think it's maybe a little bit different. I think because we had the vaccine shortage, energized a lot of folks who otherwise would not have been energized if we'd had an adequate supply of vaccine. It's when they can't get it, start getting worried about it. Oh, it must be something to this vaccine. So we have way more people energized because they couldn't get the vaccine, and it seemed like it was important that they were kind of coming out in droves. So if we had had all the vaccine at the time it was supposed to come, I'd be very curious to see if we got quite the same response. And I'm telling you, I got some nasty emails, phone calls about why they weren't on that priority list and why they should have been receiving the vaccine. And so a lot of angry people. And I had people coming from cities that were 3 hours away, because we made the decision that we were not going to turn anybody away based on what county they came from, or and we never check out whether you're illegal or not. And for people coming 3 hours away from the state to get vaccine from us, you know, that means that people are really energized about getting this vaccine.
For a little while.
Yes, for a little while, right.
I would make, I mean, there are dozens of things that could be said about the question you're raising. It's a crucial and complicated question, but I would make just 2 points. One is, you know, obviously we have a boy who cried wolf problem. The term of art for boy who cried wolf problem is warning fatigue. And the problem is real. SARS turned out to be easily controlled. Bird flu hasn't materialized yet. Swine flu became, you know, more visibly mild than we expected it to be. And, you know, so now the credibility issue, I think, is real. And the difficulty of warning either generically that it'll happen again, or specifically that I see something on the horizon that I'm worried about and I want, you know, I want people to do things, I think it's going to be harder than it would have been a few years ago. The second point that I want to make is one of the reasons it's going to be harder and one of the reasons why we've created a warning fatigue problem is because we have sounded too confident sometimes in our warnings. The model for pandemic warnings and particularly for preparedness has got to be like the people who sell fire insurance. The people who sell fire insurance don't say your house is going to burn down. It's not if but when. They don't say that. They say your house might burn down, and that would be horrific if it happened. And it's really worthwhile taking precautions so that, you know, you reduce the probability, but more importantly, for insurance, we make it more survivable. You reduce the magnitude, you get the wherewithal to continue your life. And they have created a reality where, you know, when the insurance reaches the annual renewal date, you don't say, oh shit, my house didn't burn down, they cheated me, you know, they fooled me. And the insurance industry does not have a fire insurance warning fatigue problem. We're glad that our house didn't burn down and we renew our insurance. I think we need to learn, and the skills are there. I mean, the question has answers. We need to learn how to warn people that something might happen without sounding like we're confident that it will, and without creating skepticism when it doesn't.
I just would like to echo what Peter just said, which is that I think it's much more challenging now than it was before the 2009 pandemic, because there's this perception out there that that's yesterday's story, number one, and number two, what's the big deal? It wasn't that bad. So all of it was hype, and I think it's going to be very difficult for us to convince people that it could conceivably be worse the next time, and I don't know how to get that message out to them.
I mean, contagion may help.
Well, maybe.
And linking to contagion may be a useful thing to do right now.
You know, I hope the CDC is going to do a baseline survey before the movie comes out and then afterwards to see if people's practices have changed. But
it's already out.
Right.
But not yet in Indianapolis.
Oh, wow. But I will also say that while we hollered, cried wolf, or the perception that the public may say we've cried wolf, we had an enormous thing happen from an infrastructure standpoint. And that is, I think, from the public health system or for the parts to take place in terms of being prepared for this, it was a huge learning curve. And I think we made substantial gains so that if something really does happen, we're way, way further in the game to be able to respond than we would have otherwise. But I'm going to tell you this. Floods in Missouri, Indiana, that little earthquake that happened in Virginia, we felt it in New Jersey, all the lights going out in San Diego, the power droughts, and now we got the fires in Texas going like crazy and in California. You know, I think we can kind of sometimes sell, we think about how do we sell this to say, guys, you know, something momentous can happen to you. Just look what's been going on across the landscape, and maybe this is something you need to be prepared for. So we have a lot of past disasters that are making people a little bit more conscious about maybe I need to do a little bit more in trying to prepare myself for a disaster. So I'm saying I think they're a little bit, maybe a little bit more receptive, maybe.
One last question.
Yes.
You want to jump back in? Dr. Redd.
It's a question for Peter about the distinction between some of the things that you described were simplification to the point of untruth. And it seems like there's a way of simplifying things that retains the essential details and is a clarification or using plain language rather than leaving things out. And I wonder if there's some process that people engage in simplifying things to kind of end up in something that isn't true rather than something that is omits the extraneous detail but retains the essential elements of the facts that need to be communicated.
What a wonderful question. Because it has a very academic, wonderful answer. There is a concept that the term was coined back in the 1950s, and the term is communicative accuracy. Okay? And what communicative accuracy says is you can simplify by removing any fact which, if people run across that fact later, it fits what they know already, and they don't have to recalculate. They don't have to. It doesn't make what they thought they knew seem like it must be wrong. Okay, but if there's a fact that, if you leave it out, when I find it out, you look like a liar. Okay, that's the fact you can't leave out. So if you've got 17 studies that show you're right, and one study that seems to show you're wrong. And the study that seems to show you're wrong has a crappy methodology, and you have very good reasons for thinking that study is not dispositive. Okay, and the weight of the evidence is on your side. You can simplify by getting rid of as many of the 17 studies as you like, but you can't get rid of the one that seems to say you're wrong. Because if you simplify by getting rid of that one, then when somebody tells me about that one, suddenly your whole cognitive structure falls apart. So does that help?
So, but tell me, how do you, when you're doing communication, and you might have some kind of episode where you don't want to necessarily generate panic. So when is it that you know, so maybe like the stock market's going to fall, I may give some very accurate information, but I know the whole stock market is going to fall, or you may tell your lovely wife every day, honey, you're gorgeous, you look beautiful. And maybe one day she really didn't look gorgeous and beautiful, and so you're not going to be quite accurate with her. So I think there are nuances, and I think there are timings too when we give the message out, and what's the lesser of two evils, so to speak.
I think what you're saying is there are times when, even though it diminishes us, we have to withhold a piece of information because sharing that piece of information would be devastating.
Yes.
I agree with you that there are times when that's true. I think they're rare, and I think we imagine they're common. Okay. But I'm not arguing they don't happen.
Okay.
They do happen, but you know, we hide behind that to withhold information where it's not a matter that people can't take it. They're gonna you know, freak out and kill themselves. It'll be embarrassing, or it'll lead to awkward questions, or it'll take longer in a doctor's office. It'll lead to a longer conversation that's not reimbursable. And those are not good reasons for withholding a piece of information. And again, I'm not an ethicist. I'm not saying that's unethical. I'm saying it's unwise, because if people are skeptical, if people are, in my language, if there's some outrage in the system, then when you withhold information that would support that outrage and then they find out, there's hell to pay. So this is not an ethical principle. This is a principle of successful communication. If you want a long-term relationship with people, you can't ground it in leaving out information that's going to make the conversation awkward.
Sometimes you may have to put infrastructure in place before you can release certain information.
I'll buy that.
Okay.
I'll buy that. Mm-hmm. And there's a difficult transition time. You know, I mean, if people are used to being misled a lot, then when you start telling the truth, you know, they have to recalibrate. Their first reaction is, my God, if even you are admitting that, God knows how bad the truth must be. Because if they're used to taking what you say with a grain of salt, when you start telling the truth, for a while, they're still going to take it with a grain of salt. And, you know, so there is a transition problem. But we need to get through that transition problem, you know, because we are increasingly facing a skeptical public. Mm-hmm. We created that skepticism, and now we have to address it with candor.
Can I ask my last question? So, sorry. So, if I have a resistant population, vulnerable, they have a distrust about what you're telling them in terms of the vaccine efficacy and coverage. What's the best message for them?
I would start by telling them that there's a lot of mistrust, that you understand that they don't trust you, and you understand that they have some good reasons not to trust you, and I would tell them what some of those reasons are. There's a principle in risk communication called the seesaw. There's a reasonably good chance if you spend a few minutes telling people why they don't trust you and why they're right not to trust you, they'll come back and say, you know, it's not as bad as all that, Doc. You know, I mean, you were honest about this and you really helped us out on that. And already you haven't really done anything about the substantive issue yet, but you've established by conceding that the distrust is real and not foolish, you've established a better basis for the conversation.
Okay.
With that, I thank our distinguished speakers.